Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're going to take a look at your pet's health today on the program. We'll talk about, tick and flea prevention. We can talk about your pet's teeth. My cat, Tiger, has the cleanest teeth in, I think, the state of Wisconsin. I can tell you why in just a minute. Dr. Maria Verbrugge, one of our guests today, clinical instructor of primary care at the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Maria, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
With us as well, Dr. Amy Nicholson. She's a clinical assistant professor of primary care at UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Dr. Amy, welcome to you.
Why, thank you.
We have, they're both, by the way, practicing veterinarians. They see patients through UW Veterinary Care's primary care service. In fact, Dr. Amy Nicholson, when Dr. Sandy Sawchuk retired, Dr. Amy Nicholson took that position, did you not?
I did. Big shoes to fill.
Yeah, big shoes to fill, but you're doing a good job with that. And as we talk with them, I hope you'll join in. How do you protect your pet from ticks and fleas? What type of dental care does your pet receive? And what other questions are on your mind relating to health? I hope you'll join in. Number to call 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us, the email address, ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Maria Verbrugge, let's start with you. There are lots of types of flea and tick prevention products out there. You got oral tablets, you got shampoos, you got collars for sure. First, how do they work?
Well, a lot of them are neurotoxins for arachnids, which ticks are arachnids, and they are, for the most part, meant to target receptors that the fleas and ticks have that mammals don't have, and so that's how we make them more and more toxic to the fleas and the ticks and try to make them less and less toxic for our mammals, so for our dogs and cats. There are a lot of species specificity even within the mammals. So one of the first things I think to think about is that we never want to use something that's labeled for one species and put it on another species. So always pay a lot of attention to those label directions, looking at the size, looking at the species. Some of the products that are out there that are very safe for dogs are very, very toxic to cats. So we don't want to cross over that way. Some of the things that are great for cats are toxic to rabbits. Consult
your... Be careful.
Yeah. Yeah, be very, very careful and talk to your veterinarian about what's going to be the safest for your animal.
Dr. Amy Nicholson, is one type more effective than another? I mean, you got the shampoo, you got the whatever, the collars, so forth.
Yeah, it depends a lot on the lifestyle of the dog or cat that you're referring to. And some in terms of repeatability and ease of use and client compliance. So some are every 3 months, some are every 9 months, which can be a little bit easier. For dogs that are swimming a lot or bathing a lot, certain topicals may be less desirable. So it all depends on the lifestyle of your critter.
What do you think of the social media posts that are out there?
Well, I think we've learned a lot lately about social media and how good it is at distributing information, but how good it is at distributing accurate versus inaccurate information. And so we frequently see some pretty alarming posts circulating about products that we use all the time. And so I think that as with all of the other concerns that we have about social media, take those with a grain of salt. Sometimes you'll see something and say like, oh, never use this product. And that happens to be the product that you're using right now. Take a minute, yeah. Think, see, has your animal been doing well on it? And, if you're concerned, talk to your veterinarian or look into it a little more deeply.
You know, I was thinking about social media or places to go online, and there are some at least one or two really good places to go, right?
I think the best thing you can do is to talk to your veterinarian. And a lot of veterinarians do have websites with blogs and things like that that you can look at. But they're going to know your animal well, and they're going to know the questions to ask. Like Amy referred to, is your dog swimming? Is your cat going outdoors and spending time in a barn, or is it really just like only in your house? Really specific questions to help you narrow down what's going to be safest and what's going to be most effective.
Lots of pill brands out there that people can buy. There's Frontline, there's K9, Advantix, I think there's NexGard. Are they all about the same, or what makes one product different from another?
So the type of medication in the products are different, and they target different stages of flea lifestyle or tick lifestyle. In this area, they seem to be relatively equivalent in terms of efficacy for the veterinary approved products. I would not say the same for the over-the-counter non-veterinary approved products. And so we have that freedom to kind of decide again what is best for our pet based on their lifestyle. There are certain geographic areas where that's not always true. So I came and I come from California, where I spent a good portion of my time practicing. And we had highly resistant fleas that were not responsive to the topical products like Advantage, Frontline. And so we had to rely more on the oral products like the Simparica, Bravecto, NexGard.
Okay. And, I got to believe that if you got one dog is going to be heavier or larger than, weight and age has to come into play, does it not?
Absolutely. All of the, most of the preventatives out there will have weight ranges for different size of dogs, or all of them do for dogs. Some of them do for cats. So make sure to consult that. And one of the other things that's great about the oral preventatives is that they're a little broader spectrum. They will cover things like mites, which before they came along, we really didn't have a ton of things to treat mites. Fleas and ticks are by far the most common parasites that we encounter, but it is nice to kind of have that broader spectrum also.
And can puppies take flea and tick preventives?
Yes. I nodded. Yes, they can. So they're licensed depending on the brand for certain ages. So you would just want to consult your vet to make sure it's the right age for the puppy. But yeah, usually 8 weeks, 12 weeks, 16 weeks or older, depending on the brand.
Okay. Well, our two guests, Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge, are a guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Questions for them? I hope you'll join in. Give a call. Numbers 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Rick from Rhinelander has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Rick. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. We have three dogs, and one of which, the four-year-old Golden Retriever, tends to have skin allergies and it scratches quite a bit. So we started some fish oil, some pollock oil, and it seemed to improve in addition to a veterinary shot that they give the dog. But the fish oil improved the glossiness of his coat, and less flakiness. But in the interim, I discovered that you can overdose dogs on fish oil, and it looks like 300 milligrams of this omega-3 is the prudent or best amount per 10 pounds, I guess, is what it is of weight. And my question is, since the food I'm feeding has a certain amount of fish oil in it anyhow, is it okay just to take the human fish oil capsules that where they say 300 milligrams of, there's an acronym or an abbreviation for these two fish oils that come in that escapes me right now. Is it safe to do that with the human fish oil capsules that are 1,000 milligrams but 300 milligrams of this particular omega-3 acids, amino acids?
Oh, that is a great question. It's It is the case that there's a therapeutic dose for omega fatty acids, and then it can get really confusing because there's a bunch of different fatty acids and a bunch of different ways that we quantify it, so that can be really tricky. So looking at one thing to think about first is that any of the supplements are much less regulated than anything that's actually a medication. And so hopefully, I'm guessing that you've already done your homework and convinced yourself that the product that you're buying is from a good company that is really putting in there what they say they're putting in there, which is really a very challenging part of the process. Beyond that, I'm going to say it's very likely safe. There is a therapeutic dose, but if you were to go high on the dose, I don't think that you're going to see really dramatic adverse effects unless you're really dramatically overdosing. And so as long as the dog is tolerating it well, meaning that they're not developing diarrhea from this, vomiting, anything like that, that their skin, continues to look pretty healthy. I think that it's unlikely you're going to see a problem by combining that supplement with like a regular formulated diet.
There you go, Rick. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike from Madison, let's go to you. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
You bet, Larry. Thanks for the show.
Sure.
My dog is 14 months old. It's a Morkie, part Yorkshire Terrier and part Maltese. We bought him from an Amish farm up in outside of Richmond Center. 8 months after we picked him up, we were going to get him neutered and took him to the vet. The vet did blood tests and stuff and said, no, they're not going to do... not going to allow neutering right now because the kidney values were out of whack, according to the vet. And so she put on some medication, we called in a ultrasound tech, and they did ultrasounds of the kidney, and it came back severe renal dysplasia. So I Googled that, and I said, what are the top 10 breeds? Well, our dog is not in the top 10 breeds. Then I Googled what is severe renal dysplasia symptoms, and the dog has none of those. And he's healthy. He runs. He eats. He sleeps. He poops. He does everything just fine. And my son and my daughter says, that dog's not sick. How can it be renal dysplasia? And unfortunately, the vet at one time said he's not going to live more than a year, maybe two. So I'm really thinking, is this a misdiagnosis or just what do we do?
So, Maria or Amy, let's turn to you.
All right. So I'm really sorry to hear about your little Morkie's diagnosis. That can be really tough. And Morkies are, by definition, one of the cutest little creatures in the world. So I'm really sorry about that. Renal dysplasia is a tricky, tricky diagnosis because a lot of it, the ultimate diagnosis is where you take a tissue sample of the kidney, which obviously is incredibly invasive and doesn't really change what we do. So we rely on our blood tests, we rely on our urine tests, and we rely on our ultrasound to help us kind of increase the likelihood of that diagnosis in our mind. And because these dogs are born with this kidney dysfunction, they often do really well with it. And so it's not surprising, especially in the stage where they're young and their kidney values are high but stable, that they may not show external signs of concern. So they may not show some of those signs that you'd expect with more advanced renal dysplasia, like vomiting, decreased appetite, increased thirst or urination. And so depending on the dog, I've seen some dogs remain stable for a period of time, and I've seen some that ultimately do start to progress in the severity of their kidney disease. I never think it's wrong if you're uncertain to have a second opinion or have another look at the blood work, but it's not surprising that with that diagnosis, that does fit with some of those young animals that still act totally normal, and that's what we want for them.
Yeah. Maria, anything to add to that?
Yeah, I think renal dysplasia is definitely something where we want to do everything we can to maintain the kidney function that we do have.
Okay.
And so this is definitely going to be a dog that should be heading back to the vet for blood tests and exams pretty frequently. And check in with your veterinarian then and say, like, hey, should we be monitoring blood pressure? Should we be checking blood work? Should we be changing diets and things like that to help preserve the kidney function that we have and keep him feeling as good as he is for as long as he is?
What kind of diet would you typically would be prescribed for that situation?
Oftentimes, we like to limit especially the phosphorus in the diet, they tend to be prescription diets, so diets that you have to get from a veterinarian that are limited enough in the phosphorus that they're going to prevent them from developing secondary complications over time.
Okay. Mike, I thank you for calling, and if you want to get that second opinion, as the vets here say, you can do that. But sorry for that. What happens typically in a situation like that? What is the length of time that an animal might have, or don't we know? I suppose it varies a whole lot.
It's really, really variable. And some of them will, have elevated kidney values and then just kind of hang out there for a pretty long time. Some of them, they'll just continue to steadily creep up. And then when they hit a certain threshold, then the animals will start to not feel good, start to have trouble keeping themselves hydrated and keeping their appetites and things like that. So that's why it's a great idea to just, keep monitoring that blood work pretty closely.
Mike, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Our two guests today, Dr. Amy Nicholson, a clinical assistant professor of primary care at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Maria Verbrugge, who is a clinical instructor of primary care at UW Vet School. Clara Neipert is our producer today. Trina LaSousa, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at your pet's health today. Larry Mueller here with my two guests from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, our veterinarians, Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge. Join in. Questions or comments, number to call 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to Beth in Eagle River. Beth, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. My question is regarding my dog's teeth. There's a product that we've been using for a couple months that was promoted as being good for his breath and to keep teeth clean. It's made of stabilized chlorine dioxide. You what? Just put a few drops of it in the water. I'm wondering if that's effective for keeping your dog's teeth clean. And my other question is, should you be having your dog's teeth cleaned every year or every other year?
Okay. Dr. Amy, what about it?
Yeah, all great questions. So the reason why you're probably asking this question is that there's a lot of marketing behind the different products that are out there that say that they help reduce plaque or tartar or both. And it becomes a sticky situation trying to sift through the products available to determine what truly can help your dog's dental disease. And so one really valuable resource that we use a lot is called the Veterinary Oral Health Council, or VOHC. And they have a very nice website where this is dental professionals, veterinary dentists, that actually study a lot of these products that are marketed to see if they help reduce plaque, tartar, or both. And so when I'm recommending a water additive like what you're describing, and yes, some of them do work, or a dental diet or a dental chew or a gel or any of the myriad of options that we have now, I'll refer clients to that to try to get the most educated product available in terms of what will be the best for your pet. In terms of dental therapy and whether or not you should have your dog's teeth addressed, I would say yes. We understand that dental disease is a huge problem in dogs and cats, even potentially more so than humans, with 70 to 80% of cats having signs of periodontal disease by the age of two. So much younger than what we typically think of when we look at our dog and cat population. And so having a comprehensive oral health assessment where someone, your veterinarian goes in, they anesthetize your dog, they take dental x-rays to look under the gum line where a lot of that periodontal disease occurs, and address the teeth can keep them as healthy as possible for as long as possible. And so that's something that we certainly encourage in addition to having a good at-home dental care plan, like toothbrushing, like the water additive that you mentioned, or some other treat or gel.
And what was the name of that site again? Because I'm sure people are saying, well, wait a minute, I didn't get that.
The Veterinary Oral Health Council, or VOHC.
VOHC. If you type that in, it's probably going to pop up.
Yep, absolutely.
Beth, thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. Well, that gives me a chance to mention Tiger, cat, who it had some, the vet said, well, got some problems with, you know, with his teeth. And I said, well, he hates to have, you know, he won't let me get anywhere near his mouth. And she said, well, why don't you try Greenies? And I put Greenies, started giving him Greenies. And then the next year when he went in, she says, oh my gosh, his teeth are perfect. I think the only problem I have with him now is that he wants to live on Greenies.
Me too. No. Yeah, so Greenies are actually one of the treats that are approved by the Veterinary Oral Health Council to reduce plaque and tartar. So that's a great option for your cat to try to help preserve that dental disease.
Now, do they work for dogs? Because I see Greenies for dogs, too. And some of the dogs I know, they just inhale everything.
So that's a great point. So yes, they do work for dogs, but you do need to be careful that they are, A, not inhaling them. That has been a problem. A few years ago, they got a bad rap because dogs were swallowing them whole and they were getting stuck. And that can cause, you know, some problems. So you want to make sure that the dog is being supervised when they get a larger Greenie, that they're chewing it. If they're not chewing it, it's not working. So really kind of monitoring them.
All kidding aside, I worry a little bit. Tiger doesn't eat as much of his normal food as he, you know, every time I get up, if I happen to be in the living room, he jumps up and wants to run to the kitchen with me to get more Greenies. Is that a problem? Have you seen that as a problem, Maria?
As a general rule, our goal is going to be something that's formulated should make up about 90% of their diet, because there's really smart people formulating these diets to make sure that they're balanced. And if we add in lots of other things, we can make them not balanced anymore. So we just kind of want to shoot for, if we're doing the Greenies as treats throughout the day, which is probably the most effective way to use them to clean the teeth, then try to have them be about 10% of what he's eating and not any more than that.
Yeah, he's probably higher than 10.
I will add that cats are very good at training their owners in terms of going on hunger strikes and things like that, holding out for the Greenies. So it can be a battle of wills.
Yeah, I've cut down the number per time.
That
he's only getting a couple instead of a handful of eight.
Perfect.
Or nine. Yeah. All right. Well, enough about me. Let's go to Elizabeth in Madison next. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, good morning. So I'll do the best job I can of explaining this. My husband actually was at the appointment with a new veterinarian, and our dog has always done well with one of the flea and tick collars. I forget the name. It's made by Bayer, so it's one of the Celeste, that's it. And for whatever reason, this veterinarian doesn't like it. He said there's something that's more effective, and it also includes heartworm. And I don't know. I just wondered if it's always worked, what the concern is.
Wow, that's a great question. I think that's probably the first place to go, is to say, if this has been working great for you, If it's not broke, maybe you don't need to fix it. So the nice thing about the collars is that the Seresto collar is labeled to last for 8 months. And if you haven't been seeing problems with it, that's something you can put on, make sure that it fits well, that it's close to the skin. And then you don't have to think about it for 8 months. And we all have plenty to keep us busy in our lives. So something that is that convenient is great. And then you are remembering to do that heartworm preventative on the side. As far as convenience, there is a certain convenience to having your flea and tick and heartworm all in one. So that'd be another thing to think about. But I'm going to say if it seems like it's working and you're not seeing any problems, any effects or concerns, I think that you're really probably doing the right thing and seeing, you know, what works best for you and for your animal.
Yeah. Elizabeth, thank you for calling. Jerry and Franklin, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jerry.
Hi.
Are you there? Oh, we lost Jerry. Well, I'll tell you what. I think we lost Jerry. Let's take an email from Wendy. She just returned from her vet for her 2-year-old dog's annual visit. The dog started showing signs of plaque. A vet suggests she starts brushing her dog's teeth. Wendy is going to try, but is wondering what's the best dog toothpaste or toothbrush.
Sure.
Yeah. Go ahead.
So great. So Amy. I love the fact that your vet recommended toothbrushing. That is super important for maintaining dental health care and the best thing that you can do at home. So daily brushing is considered the gold standard or the best thing that you can do to prevent dental disease. In terms of the products, the main important factor is to have a dog or cat toothpaste. There are human toothpastes out there that have ingredients that can be toxic to dogs. So it needs to be a dog or cat approved toothpaste. Again, I would encourage you to visit the VOHC website. They do have some toothpastes on there that have been studied to also reduce plaque or tartar. So in addition to the motion that you get from abrading the tooth with your finger or with a toothbrush, these toothpastes can also help reduce plaque or tartar on their own. And then in terms of the type of brush, there's a lot of options. You can certainly use a finger cover, and that's a good place in my experience to start and kind of train your animal and yourself in terms of the movement that is involved with brushing. Or you can use any soft bristled toothbrush.
Yeah, and now the dog's already 2. It's probably a good idea to get them started younger if you can.
Absolutely. We encourage during puppy and kitten visits that they start brushing. Even though all those baby teeth are going to come out, great for practice. You can't mess them up. So it's a good opportunity to start and get the habit in when these puppies and kittens are more accepting of new things.
Any electric ones out there?
I have had one client that used an electric toothbrush on her dog, and her standard poodle's teeth were beautiful. But that is very rare and requires pretty significant training. So usually not.
Okay. Russ in Manitowoc, we'll go to you next. Hi, Russ.
Yeah, good morning, Larry. Good program as always.
Thank you.
We've got a 12-year-old golden retriever, the English model, the white one. Absolutely the best dog in the world. And the question is, it seems like the last year or so, she has a tendency when she goes outside, she always wants to try to chew on some grass or weeds when I'm out taking her for a walk. And she's getting fed, so it's not the point is that we're not feeding the dog. But I was wondering, is that an indication that she's got something going on internally for her? And it also is going to segue to the fact that her breath is really foul. And we practice good hygiene with the dog. So I'm just thinking maybe there's – what would you think? Just kind of a quick review here.
That's a great question. I think it's a question that comes up a lot is why is my dog eating grass? And there can be any number of reasons. If it's a new behavior for her, I would wonder if it might be related to a change in her health. If it's something new that she's doing, we do think that sometimes when animals are nauseous, they're more likely to eat grass, but not always. Sometimes it's just like, well, it's there, and they're scavengers. They really like to eat a lot of different things. So if it's not a new behavior, then I'd say it's probably not concerning. So it may be good to, you know, kind of get her in and get her examined just to see, okay, are we missing something? If she's having any other evidence of nausea, is she like licking her lips? Is she, you know, has her dietary preferences changed, or is she like not really wanting to eat at certain times? Those would all be other clues, I think, that we might have some nausea or something going on. As far as the breath, I think it would be, again, pretty good to check in with your veterinarian and see if maybe we've been trying to do the tooth brushing. But brushing is great for preventing dental disease, but it isn't really going to do much if we have some dental disease established. So it may be time to check in and see, is it time for one of those anesthetized dental procedures to go looking and x-raying and seeing if there's more going on under the surface.
Yeah. Yeah. And I imagine if there's a problem with the teeth, I mean, if there's something going on, that's going to affect the dog in other, can affect the dog in other ways.
Absolutely. We have, anytime we have problems with the teeth, we're thinking about infections and maybe even tooth root abscesses. And that's just a source of inflammation for the rest of the body, which isn't really good for our systemic health.
Russ, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Jerry in Franklin, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on this morning.
Sure.
Appreciate it. It was interesting that you're just talking about the Seresto flea collar. This is something that we've found to be very dangerous, and there was an article in CBS News, Seresto flea collar, this was in June, should be recalled after 2,500 pet deaths. Lawmakers say this is a congressional study. We had a 13-year-old standard poodle, and we used that flea collar on her, and she started having seizures after a few weeks of using it, a few months, I should say, and she was doing things like pooping in the house, which she never did before. So, and we think it led to her premature death. We just thought it was due to her age of 13 that this was something that was happening to her. But we are convinced that this flea collar caused her premature death. And all the articles that we're seeing regarding this Seresto flea collar leads us to believe that it should not be on the market.
So have you seen some of those stories and seen some of those articles?
Absolutely. So I'm really sorry to hear about what happened with your poodle. That's always really difficult to have, you know, kind of a spectrum of mysterious, you know, symptoms come up all at once. Back in June, there was a congressional subcommittee looking at Seresto collars, which is somewhat unusual. Typically the role of the EPA to look at pesticides and to label and things like that. And I've been watching that story, and since June, I really haven't seen much come out in terms of what they've actually found. And the problem with the number of 2,500 is I don't think, I'm not aware that any of that has actually been, kind of studied from a scientific standpoint, saying, number one, the people that are reporting these linkages, did they buy a Seresto collar? Did they buy a different type of collar? Or did they actually buy a counterfeit collar, which is absolutely a thing, that there's big money in flea and tick preventatives. And so they produce, there are people that produce counterfeit collars that look similar, but aren't actually Seresto collars. And then was that symptom actually truly related, or did it happen at the same time? Because we all know that things can, we can see correlations that don't necessarily mean that one thing caused another. And then finally, are we seeing kind of the same spectrum of syndromes, symptoms coming up over and over, or are we seeing a bunch of different things, which kind of makes us think that it may or may not be related. And so I haven't really seen any of that data come through in a convincing way as far as, you know, have the scientists, the people that look at this, you know, have they seen a pattern? So hopefully that information comes out.
Yeah, something definitely we'd want to keep an eye on for sure. Jerry, I'm sorry you lost your pet. And I appreciate your call. Thank you so much for calling today. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to ideas at WPR.org. Listener emailed with a couple of questions. Their dogs are on a monthly dose of Simparica Trio. Is it overkill to also get the Lyme vaccine? They do hike in areas where the dogs may go into long grass.
That is a fantastic question. Yeah, so Simparica Trio is one of those products that treats fleas, ticks, and heartworm all in one. So as long as you remember to give that once a month, you should be preventing that whole group of critters, and that's fantastic. Any of the flea and tick preventatives that are out there are going to tend to be 98-99% effective. And there's certainly areas out there that are tick infested enough that I could picture walking through and winding up with, you know, 100 ticks. And so if I'm 98-99% effective, maybe I'm still going to get one or two sneaking through. And so absolutely, even though, you know, my dogs are on preventatives, when I walk them out in the woods, I'm going to check them afterwards. And I don't think it's overkill in that situation to think about adding that Lyme vaccine on top.
Hmm. And their 7-year-old Weimaraner was recently diagnosed with ITP, which I think is an immune system problem where it attacks the platelets.
Yep.
And is but responding well to prednisone. Is it okay to cut off water an hour before bedtime so she doesn't get me up in the night to pee? They've tried this the last two nights and can tell she wants water. She has 2 more weeks of 20 milligram prednisone twice daily, and then the plan is to taper the dose. Any ideas on this or suggestions on natural remedies or supplements?
Yeah, so... So I'm sorry to hear that your Weimaraner has ITP. That is, like Larry said, an immune condition affecting the platelet count. And the best way that we know to treat it is with a high dose of steroid. And you're experiencing those lovely side effects that we see with high dose of steroids. So that increased thirst, increased urination, often increased appetite and panting. And that can become really hard. I'm glad that you only have a few weeks left that you have to deal with these really severe signs before you start tapering. One thing I would suggest is if you're noticing these really bad side effects of the steroid, it may be worth a call to your veterinarian just to say, these are the side effects we're seeing. Is there a way that we can manage this differently? Since sometimes there are different medications we can add. They all have their own slew of side effects. So it's just something to kind of weigh the pros and cons of. But that may allow you to lower the dose of steroids more quickly. In terms of taking away water, yeah. I always get hedgy with that because if he's really thirsty, you know, we know that dogs on steroids, you know, they drink a lot and they pee a lot and it kind of goes hand in hand. So certainly if it's keeping you up in the middle of the night, you could consider that, but try to do that as minimally as possible because you don't want him to get dehydrated or anything like that.
And thanks very much for that question. Dr. Amy Nicholson, clinical assistant professor of primary care at UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and Dr. Maria Verbrugge, who is a clinical instructor of primary care at UW School of Vet Medicine. Our guests today, I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health today on the program, Larry Mueller here with my two guests from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge. Great to have them with us. And our lines are all filled, so let's just go right back to the phones and to Joe in Nina. Joe, thanks for calling.
Well, thanks for having my call. You know, it's a dog's world. Us cat owners sometimes left out. Sometimes we feel that way. But I have a cat that I rescued a few years ago. It's 5 years old. Neo crawled out from under my deck. And after 5 years, all I do is really keep her indoors. She's never been outdoors. So when I hear about all these medications, I begin to wonder. I do give her Greenies dental treats every meal in the morning and in the evening. She gets those skin and fur and sensitive stomach and all of those dental treats. But other than that, I don't use collars. I've never worried about fleas. I'm just wondering if I should be worried about this stuff. She stays indoors, so I don't know what it is indoors that can get at her. Her name is Miu.
That's super cute. That is definitely true that it is. We do pay a lot more attention sometimes to dogs, and that cats get a little bit of the short end of the stick. So I'm glad that you love your kitty, and she's so lucky that she crawled out from under your deck and found you. Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think we can look at this in a couple different ways. Number one is how can she get exposed to fleas? A lot of times fleas will originate from wildlife, things like rabbit nests and things like that. And so it's not too far out of the realm of possibility that you could be walking around one day and walk past a rabbit's nest, and the fleas that are emerging from there could hop onto you, ride into the house, and then set up shop. If you have a dog, I think that's even a little bit more likely that dogs could be sniffing around, pick up a couple of fleas, carry them in. And all it takes then is two fleas and one animal that's not on preventatives. But with that said, the preventatives that we have are good enough now that I think, if you do get an infestation, treat every animal in the household. And over the course of 8 weeks or so, you're going to be able to eliminate them. And so if you're kind of up for tolerating the risk of that happening, honestly, I don't put preventative on my cats right now. My cats are not going outside, and I'm willing to take that on. And if I see fleas, I will get preventative on them, and we'll clear it out. Be aware that once you get a flea infestation established, those larval and pupal stages of the fleas will be in bedding, in any place where the cat goes. So carpeting, furniture, and they'll be there for about 6 weeks. So you will keep seeing fleas for about 6 weeks. And so if you'd rather not deal with that and you want to prevent that, then you put some preventatives on your kitty. And then as far as internal parasites, if your cat, even though it's indoors only, might head down to the basement and, catch a mouse here and there and would actually eat said mouse, that is a way that they can be exposed to internal parasites. And so in that situation, any cat that is hunting or scavenging, parasite prevention would be appropriate for them as well.
There you go, Joe. And don't forget, your cat can sometimes lean up against the screen, and then the screen kind of breaks open and the cat rolls out, and then the cat's running around for a week or so before you can find it. Now, I'm speaking from experience here. My cats are indoor cats too, but that happened to a tiger, and it was an agonizing time. But tigers, frankly, I keep her on all of it, everything. So I keep them on everything. So that wasn't the biggest problem for me. But they can get out.
Yep. Also, a fantastic reason to have your cat wear a collar with some identification on it, and have a microchip, so that if they do get out, they can make their way back to you as soon as possible.
Absolutely. Thanks again, Joe. Mary in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I adopted two cats. I'm their second mom, and they had to part with the cats due to some allergies in their children. But the one cat who's six has consistently for 5 months now had no inclination to use the litter box. Urinating outside the box is every day, and she's been defecating without my knowledge with both cats. I thought I had it cleaned up from both cats, and turns out I found her defecation elsewhere. But I've used the unscented clay clumping litter like the first mom did. I used Litter Attract, the product that is supposed to attract them to litter. And I've ended up putting the absorbent pads on the floor, Chuck's pads, just to help me maintain sanity. The young cat is 6 years old. I've had her to the vet. She had a health exam. She seems healthy. But they put her on meloxicam and gabapentin, possibly for inflammation and then just, you know, for the pain if she's having pain urinating. And I take her into the vet tomorrow for a recheck. So they want me to try to bring a urine sample in. And then also, should I bring a feces sample and get tested for that? And any other ideas would be appreciated.
How many litter boxes do you have, by the way?
I have four litter boxes. Okay. And I got a covered litter box. Someone suggested that, and it's private. She's a smaller 8-pound cat. The second cat is 10 pounds. He's 2 years older. He's 8. And he's a bigger cat. He's fluffy. But they've been together for 6 years. And I asked the first mom if she had these issues at her house, and she said no, she didn't. So I've tried the litter boxes in four different locations, four corners in my basement, and she did it this morning right next to the litter box.
Hmm. Okay, so a lot to unpack there, Dr. Amy. What do you think?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm really sorry you're having to go through this. I, too, have a cat that has had a history of litter box problems, and I can empathize. It is no, you know, easy feat to try to figure it out. And I'm really glad that you've been to the veterinarian. I think getting a urinalysis or a urine sample like they recommended is a super important first step to just make sure there's nothing medically going wrong on her end. You know, sometimes we'll run blood work and things like that as well. But a lot of times this ends up being behavioral. And so especially when you're mentioning the urinating outside the box and the defecating outside the box, and that can be a really hard thing to navigate. So often what we'll do is what Larry already suggested, which is asking about the number of litter boxes. So having usually one litter box per cat plus one is our rule of thumb. So four litter boxes for two cats should be ample to give her the options that she may desire. Sometimes having them covered, sometimes having them uncovered, trying different litter types. I couldn't get from what you were saying, if all the litter boxes are in the basement, you may want to try to have some litter boxes on different floors. Any area where she feels like she could be safe and comforted. And sometimes there's a dynamic between two cats, even though they've been together for 6 years and doing great. So in some cases, I'll keep an eye out and see if there's any evidence of one cat blocking the other from going down into the basement, or stress or anxiety that could be linked. And then there's certainly some options in terms of pheromones and things that you can try on top of the litter box suggestions, like Feel Away. The Ohio State University has a really nice handout on indoor cat education for guidance in terms of number of litter boxes, litter box suggestions and placement, but also some of the indoor enrichment that can be helpful for urinary issues at home as well, once all the medical conditions have been ruled out.
And where's that again? Ohio State?
Ohio State University, the Indoor Cat Network.
At Ohio State University.
Yeah.
All right. Mary, there you go. Thanks for very much for calling. Bruce in Houston, Minnesota. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Yeah, the question I have has to do with a twisted stomach. I had a dog that had one this past winter. It's a working dog. I'm curious to know, is it the breed or is it the food? I've been told a dog that's been working hard that day eats its food too fast, or is it water? They take in water too quickly, or is it genetics? And how long a period of time do you really have to get them to a vet to fix it? Because when I grew up on the farm and I had help and I realized cows are different than dogs, I remember Grandpa having to take the cow and hooking it up to the hay rack, and then he would punch the belly and then roll it to untwist the stomach.
Probably wouldn't want to do that to the dog. By the way, what's the breed your dog?
It's the Plot breed, but I've seen it also in the Walker breed.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, do you want to?
Go
okay,
ahead.
I'll go for ahead. It.
Go ahead, Dr. Amy.
So I'm sorry to hear about your dog with the twisted stomach. In general, there is a genetic basis. So when we look at the prevalence of the twisted stomach, or you know, the gastric dilation volvulus, which is the scientific name for it, there are certain breeds that are at a higher risk. And we typically think of those deep-chested dogs. So we can see it in any breed. I've seen it in a Maltese before. But certainly we typically think of the Great Danes, the Weimaraners, the working dogs that you classically mentioned. And so there's been lots of studies looking at different factors ranging from how fast they eat, what they eat, how fast they exercise after they eat, how much water they drink, how much activity they get. And there's been nothing that significantly correlates with the prevalence.
And we'll talk some more about that. You can ponder that some more, Amy. And we'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with our veterinarians from the UW Vet School. Taking a look at your pet's health today on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here with my guests, Dr. Maria Perugi and Dr. Amy Nicholson, who are both with the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. They're both practicing veterinarians and see lots of animals. And if you've been listening the last hour, you know they know a whole lot. So I hope you'll join in with your own questions as we talk your pet's health. And we did have a caller who was talking about a dog that had a twisted stomach. You were talking, Amy, about dealing with it. And I know you had some more to add to that.
Yeah, so, you know, basically, I think where we kind of had to end it was that there's been no clear cause or predictive value that leads to a twisted stomach other than genetics. And so in breeds that we know are predisposed to a torsion or a GDV or a twisted stomach, oftentimes what we'll recommend is that at the age of when they are spayed or neutered, that we consider doing a gastropexy on them. And what a gastropexy is it's basically we tack the stomach to the side of the body wall to help prevent it from twisting later on. And so that is something that we'll recommend for our at-risk breeds or on a case-by-case basis. If you have a familial line, you know, Basset Hounds are shockingly one of those breeds that are more likely to get a twisted stomach, even though they're not that classic deep-chested. In terms of the time frame, if you have a dog that has a twisted stomach and signs are going to be things like retching but not able to produce any vomiting, really discomfort, pacing, distended abdomen, time is of the essence. We know that the longer that these stomachs stay twisted, the worse the prognosis. And so that is a situation where you'd want to get to the emergency hospital as soon as possible. They will often decompress the stomach. Dogs are not like cows. Cows have, you know, four chambers to their stomach, and so that's situated differently. And so the treatments are going to be different for dogs and cows.
And home remedies, are there any?
There are no home remedies. So it's a true physical twisting. And so there's no way to really get it untwisted without decompressing the stomach. So that requires veterinary intervention.
All right. There we go. Good questions. Thanks again for that call earlier. Tom in Bellevue, we'll go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I've had about 10 dogs, but they've all been females. And I've got my first male, and we're going to have him spayed. Or spayed. Can't spay him. We're going to have him neutered. And I'm wondering, what are the disadvantages to neutering a male dog?
All right. I think that is it's a great question, and it's one that Amy and I definitely enjoy talking about. We are always wishing that there was a little bit more evidence, because I think a lot of the things that veterinarians have been saying for years are not necessarily as supported by evidence as we would like them to be. So first off, some of the myths surrounding neutering. There's not much in the way of evidence that neutering is going to change behavior or drive or really a lot of the like energy level, where people are often have a young dog and they're really hoping that spaying and neutering is going to calm the dog down or make the dog pay better attention or things like that. So very unlikely to cause behavior much significant in the way of behavior change other than sexually motivated behaviors like going after female dogs and mounting or urine marking, things like that. So we do expect neutering to help with that. As far as disadvantages of neutering, a lot of the studies that are out there are well, first of all, there aren't a lot of studies out there. And the ones that are, there are correlation studies, meaning that when we see, you know, we look at populations of animals after the fact and we say, okay, are neutered dogs more likely to have had this happen to them? But those aren't always, you know, demonstrating causation, even if we do manage to demonstrate a correlation. And so we often, even where there are studies, we often don't have a very good level of evidence to say, oh, because this dog was neutered, that's why this happened. So there are some studies out there to suggest that large breed dogs might do better orthopedically if they're allowed to grow to full size before we neuter them. But like I said, it's not a very strong level of evidence. Other than that, things that neutering will definitely prevent, so good positive aspects of neutering, it will definitely prevent testicular cancer because they're not going to have testicles anymore. It's not that common of a disease in dogs, and it isn't also that you know, severe of a disease because often it's quite treatable when it's caught. Neutered dogs are dramatically less likely to have benign prostatic hyperplasia, just benign growth of the prostate, which can cause problems, can cause cysts and infections and things like that. So that's definitely something that I would recommend, that dogs be neutered at least before they reach middle age in order to prevent that. And then we also know that neutering drops metabolism. And so if we continue to feed a dog who's neutered as if he was not neutered, there's a good chance that he will get fat. But I will not say that neutering causes animals to get fat because ultimately it's overfeeding. So it is something that you do have to pay attention to both before and after neutering.
Tom, good question. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Ken in Libertyville, Illinois. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a male neutered cat who's about 12, domestic short hair, and he, for the last, we've had him for about 5 years, and for about the last year and a half, he is very boogery and sneezy. So we have taken him, and so not just sneezing, but, you know, lots of mucus. His eustachian tubes are continually blocked, and so I, you know, need to clear eye boogers and stuff out, and his eyes always look just a titch watery. Behaviorally, he's fine, as far as we can tell. But he will have, like, little sneezing fits, and, you know, he'll produce a bunch of mucus and, of course, lick it up, which is beautiful. So we've taken him to the vet a couple times, and one time, maybe 3 or 4 months after this started happening, he seemed like he might have had a sinus infection, and he did. So they sedated him. They took some x-rays in addition to, you know, flushing out his sinuses and all that, which are, you know, very teeny tiny in a cat. And they said there was, you know, a ton of mucus in there and stuff, and but they have no idea what's causing it. And so he has not had any diet changes, no litter type changes, and we're just kind of at a loss as to what to do. I mean, his quality of life is decent, but it could be better.
Yeah, so that can be a really hard case to get through as your vet is experiencing it, as you're experiencing, because there's a lot of things that can cause these cats as they age to be congested and have some of that sneezing and boogers that you described. And so the first thing that your vet already did is taking a look up the nose, flushing it out. Sometimes we can get some answers there. There's a lot of reasons why they can be boogery and congested, ranging from really superficial things like infection or either bacterial or viral. But cats also love to get allergies, or they can also get an immune response in their nose called lymphoplasmacytic rhinitis, which is just an inflammatory response in the nose. And cats love to get inflammatory diseases everywhere. That's just a thing that they love to do. And so we kind of call it the diabetes of the nose, because it's an immune response. It's always there. It can be really hard and tricky to manage. Ultimately, the way that you diagnose that and the way that you exclude some other diseases besides those bacterial or viral infections and besides those allergies is imaging. And so while x-rays are really good at kind of getting a rough assessment of the bone structure and of the nasal exam or of the nasal turbinates, sometimes we need more advanced imaging like a CT scan or actually taking biopsy samples with a little scope up the nose called a rhinoscopy. And once you get those tissue samples, then you can get a more definitive answer that can help guide treatment. That can also, you know, the imaging can also help you eliminate other causes that may be on there, like certain masses or cancers. So it sounds like they've done a lot of the empirical treatment, but it may be that we need a little bit more information to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah. Good luck, Ken. Thank you so much for calling. Louise in Dodgeville, we'll give you a chance. Hi, Louise.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I actually have a question about the pet caregivers, so veterinaries. I read a recent Isthmus article that vets are, there's a shortage. I know vets can, it's a stressful job. So I was wondering if the UW ever considered creating kind of like a physician's assistant, you know, program, like what on the human level, but for animals, just to get more caregivers in the system. Just curious your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, and thank you. Thanks for the great question, and thanks for caring about the health of the field, because it has been especially challenging in the past few years. Something like that, because we're a licensed profession, something like that would have to come from, kind of not from the UW or any of the individual institutions, but it would have to come from, probably the national institution, the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association, and really would have to be something that states would have to individually introduce and legalize in order to have another paraprofessional. What we have right now is we have veterinarians who are licensed, and then we have either veterinary technicians or veterinary nurses who are also licensed. And, I think related to that, one thing that we find is that the more we can empower our veterinary nurses to do more, that does definitely add into, how many clients we can see, how many patients we can take care of, and definitely the quality of the medicine that we can offer to our patients. So there is definitely work being done to try to graduate more veterinarians and try to graduate more veterinary nurses out there, and to be as efficient as we can.
You were talking earlier, off air, about the fact that we've had a huge increase in the number of pets. People, during COVID, a lot of people who didn't have pets now have pets.
Absolutely. And that's really contributed to, you know, I think before COVID, there were shortages in certain parts of veterinary medicine, in food animal, things like that. But I think the new pet ownership happened during COVID, kind of really pushed that and exposed the shortage of veterinarians a lot more. Meanwhile, as veterinarians, we're trying to figure out how to function in COVID, just like everybody else was, that really kind of pushed a little bit of a crisis onto the profession, that I think we're still, kind of navigating our way back from.
Yeah. Good question, Louise. Thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call. And they're just not making a whole lot more vet schools either. There's a finite number, at least on the moment, of veterinary educational institutions, and you can only have so many at each institution depending on how many staff or faculty are.
Absolutely. Over the years, some of the schools have, or most of the schools have kind of gradually increased their class sizes, but a lot of times that's also limited by, how much they can offer, what their
sure.
staffing is like.
Yeah, makes sense. Joan in Mequon, your turn. Hi, Joan.
Hi, thanks for giving me a chance to call. I have an 8-year-old Springer Spaniel who has been intermittently bleeding from her right nostril. She's been seen by a couple of vets, including the emergency room vets and specialty. They're recommending a CT scan or in possibly a rhinoscopy, diagnose what's going on. My own vet says probably 95% chance that it's a nasal tumor or a fungal infection. At this point, she's being, she isn't having any episodes. The only medication she would be given should that happen is some Yunnan Bio, which seems to help. At this point, I don't think with her age that I would put her through any sort of radiation treatments or that sort of thing. And I'm just wondering what other insights you may have into her issues.
Yeah, so I'll try to help with that one. I'm sorry about that situation. It sounds like it's very stressful for you and for her. It can be hard with these situations to know how far to take these things. And it sounds like that's the trouble that you're having, as well as deciding how aggressive do I go if I'm not going to do those next steps in terms of radiation. Will it change what we do? And in this area, the one thing that I think, first of all, making sure, and I'm sure your vet already did this, ruling out bleeding disorders and things like that that can cause nasal bleeding. But we do see fungal diseases in this area too, and that would be treated differently than a cancer. And so in some cases, even if we weren't going to go forward with, follow-up cancer therapy, sometimes it's worth knowing, is this something that could be managed in a different way? And so having that information may be helpful to help guide in that sense.
Yeah. Joan, thank you for calling. Dennis in Sussex, hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you could recommend a specialist in Southeast Wisconsin that's got a proven track record in treating megasophagus.
I don't know that I know the area well enough to even know if there are specialty clinics near you. So I'm not sure. Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about what's going on and what you're having troubles with.
Oh, we've been maintaining our 8-year-old black mouth cur for about a year and a half, 2 years now. We're kind of losing the battle, but we think we're experts on it because it's been so long. But we've built a couple of Bailey chairs. We feed him with a cool down period. We've been doing antibiotics, probiotics, acid reflux medicines. And he still crashes. We call it a crash about every week or so, where he'll do really good for about a week, week and a half, and then he'll go in a 2-day crash. And He's lost a lot of weight. He's gone from 70 pounds. He's probably down to about 50. And
boy,
I was just wondering if that's necessarily terminal, or is there, you know, it seems like this can't be the only dog that's ever had that.
Yeah,
it does. It sounds like you maybe you are the regional expert, because it does sound like you're doing a lot of the right things for him. I think to go further, you may just need to travel and see if you can maybe get an appointment with an internal medicine specialist. And I believe if you go to the website for the ACVIM, the American College of Veterinary Internal Medicine, I think most of the colleges have a find a specialist spot on their website. So you may be able to at least find somebody that's as close to you as possible. And they may be able to give you some more ideas as far as, you know, kind of what's causing the crashing and how to prevent the next one. It does sound like a pretty tough situation that you guys are doing a really good job with.
Yeah. Do we have somebody like that at the UW Vet School? Offhand, you might know?
Yeah, we definitely do. We have a whole internal medicine team that's quite fantastic.
Yeah. So, and obviously Dennis could call and make an appointment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Dennis, good luck. I'm sorry for the issues that you're having in your family there. Appreciate your call very much. We had, there was something I wanted to bring up because there's sort of a like parvovirus-like problem going on in northern Michigan, Amy, and what do we know about it?
Yeah. So I'll let Maria help as well, but basically we don't know a lot about it. And so that's the frustrating and sometimes scary thing. But it does seem like there's been an outbreak of a disease that is closely mimicking the signs that we associate with parvovirus, in the sense of diarrhea, vomiting, affecting younger dogs. So under 2 years of age seem to be most affected. A lot of these dogs are not vaccinated for parvo, but some of them are vaccinated, which is a little unusual since parvo vaccine tends to be very effective. And interestingly, they don't seem to be testing positive on for parvovirus, at least on the initial screening tests. And so on autopsy, it seems like parvovirus is the most likely culprit, but we still have a lot of information that's waiting to come out that we just need to figure out. So in the meantime, I think it just gives us a nice reminder that we need to make sure that our puppies are not exposed to high-risk situations. So if I have an unvaccinated dog, I'm not taking them to dog parks or to areas of uncertain where other dogs with unknown vaccine status are interchanging. Making sure that we are doing our full vaccine course according to the American Association of Hospitals guidelines for making sure that we're boostering them appropriately and preventing as much as we can.
Well, on that note, here we are out of time. I want to thank you both very much. Will you come back and be with us again? We'd love to have you back.
Sure, that would be great.
Absolutely.
Love to have you back. Dr. Amy Nicholson and Dr. Maria Verbrugge are guests today from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Well, they do a great job, and it was fun having them, and it was great having you listening in as well, and I hope you'll even tune in tomorrow. It's a Wednesday, so that's Environment Outdoor Time, and we'll talk about beavers tomorrow and how they help our state's rivers, and then we get an update on invasive plants that you might be dealing with during late summer and into early fall. So that begins tomorrow at 11 on the Ideas Network, but in the meantime, I hope you stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.